projects. It's called Transition Towns. Now, you may be in a position of having never heard of them. Don't worry, because here to enlighten us is Mark Stephen. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Guy.
What on earth are we talking about then?
Underpinning the idea of transition towns is something called peak oil, which basically states that oil and gas is finite, and there's going to come a point where demand actually exceeds supply, and it becomes increasingly expensive to produce oil and gas. Now, given how oil-dependent we are, how accustomed we've become to the idea of cheap oil, what do we actually do under those circumstances? And that's what transition towns are, saying, look, rather than this sneaking up on us and biting us on the bum, let's prepare for this, let's think about it in advance, and let's just try and smooth the transition. One of the main people behind it, really the founder of the movement of transition towns, is Rob Hopkins.
Let's hear from him now. Oh, we can't hear from him at the moment. So let's just move on to talk about Totness itself. This is a community in the southwest of England. It's united in this scheme, but what exactly does it involve? What do they do?
There's a whole variety of ideas, and on the surface of it, some of them seem quite silly, to be honest. Some are pretty bizarre. Recently, they've been experimenting with their own currency, the Totness pound. Now, before you ask, they've printed about £10,000 worth of these things. Before you ask, you cannot copy these things. They're actually pretty clever.
Yeah, I think that would be a worry for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, my idea was if I could get hold of one and then find a photocopying shop, I could be a millionaire by the end of the afternoon. But they are pretty sophisticated, and Mariana Koss showed me one of them and then explained what the point of it was.
We can't hear from her either, but we'll get that sorted out in just a moment or two, and we'll come back to hearing from them. Local currency, interesting idea, and I suppose it's one that's been used in different areas. You know, there's sort of barter schemes and things going on, but what else is involved in this?
Well, I can go on to that, but given the fact we haven't had Mariana, maybe she'd explain what that was about. The currency, again, the idea is to focus people locally. It's a localization program. It's saying, look, instead of spending money across the other side of the world, instead of bringing in carrots from South Africa, which makes absolutely no sense at all, let's think about how we actually benefit ourselves and think in terms of a local unit. The £10,000 that they've produced, and I asked, one of the questions I said to her was, how does the Chancellor feel about this? And she said, well, we haven't actually got around to telling them yet.
I think they might find out soon enough.
I think they might well do it, but certainly, I mean, if this scheme spreads, it could actually be a bit of a concern to them. But the idea is that you can only spend that with participating units locally. You know, you can't take a Totness pound and go and spend it on the other side of Devon. That just doesn't work. And a lot of these things are really aid memoirs. I mean, they are intended to make people think before they do everyday tasks. Another thing that they've embarked upon, that they want to name themselves the Nut Tree Capital of the UK. They originally thought about calling themselves the Nut Capital of the UK, and it didn't make any sense at all because too many people were smiling and nodding seriously.
Yes.
But again, they're just saplings at the moment. But the idea is that, you know, pound for pound, or acre for acre, they're actually more productive than actually planting grain or anything else of the kind. And instead of having all this empty space, I mean, Pacific Kiwi sitting in the building at the moment in Glasgow, it's got huge areas of grass sitting around outside it. That is a luxury which our forefathers immediately after the Second World War would have thought was insane. I mean, just about every square foot of ground was used for productive use. Mm. And they're saying, if you get to the stage where oil is more expensive and you cannot bring stuff from the other side of the world, where the supermarkets cannot use enormous lorries to bring stuff in on a daily basis, what do you do? How do you go back to actually producing the foodstuffs that you require locally?
So on the issue of these nut trees then, is this something that they would actually use to sustain themselves, or would they use that to sell to buy other products?
To be honest, there's not enough at this. I mean, they're tiny wee things, about 7 or 8 feet tall. There's not enough at this stage. They'll be productive in about 5 years' time. They may well end up eating the produce. But again, the intention is to, every time somebody passes one of those things, if they spot them, they'll be thinking, well, hang on a second, where am I getting my food from? What am I doing here? You know, what am I doing to actually produce the resources I require?
And in terms of other things that they're doing, I mean, how popular is all of this? Is everybody signed up for it?
Surprisingly, yes. I mean, I went down there with the full expectation that it would be the usual coterie of sandal-wearing hippies and, you know, greeny tree hugging, and it wasn't that at all. I mean, it, some very, very sensible ideas came out of this. There's a swap shop that goes on, and they've got a lady whose sole job is to try and to make connections between various businesses. Now, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about businesses here. We're trying to save businesses money. One of the ideas she came up with was, she spotted that most companies were having to pay to get their cardboard taken away. Most cardboard arrives in the form of boxes. She then found a firm, a removal firm, who was having to drive 50 miles to buy cardboard boxes. And she said, well, this is daft. And she put the two units together, and all of a sudden, everybody is saving money on that. And this is pretty hard-nosed. I mean, the intention is really to say, right, okay, how do we go about turning what has been a liability in the past into something positive? And the chap running the local Chamber of Commerce is 100% behind this.
But the problem, I would imagine, is that when it comes to us being more productive, trying to produce our own food, etc., many of us just don't have the skills. You know, well, it's not a trip to the supermarket, we're lost.
Absolutely. And it, again, skilling is part of this. Rob Hopkins, who's the founder of the movement Transition Towns, has basically said, you know, we've never had such an unskilled generation. We are absolutely hopeless at looking after ourselves. He says, and that's got to change. And that's something they're looking at too. How do we let men, and he took it to extremes, I must confess. He was talking about, how do you make a clay plaster in terms of actually plastering the front of your house? And, you know, how would you build a house from scratch using those materials? And if you take it to extremes, that's the kind of level you need to start thinking of. If you can't go and get breeze blocks out of B&Q or Travis Perkins or wherever it is, where do you actually, you know, get the stuff to build a house from?
I think I'd still need to call somebody in, but maybe that's just me being useless. This is an idea that's seems to be working quite well, though, yes, as you say, in Devon. What are the implications for Scotland?
There are already six communities in Scotland that have expressed an interest. There's East and West Kilbride, there's Dunbar, there's Portobello. Don't ask me what the sixth one is because I can't remember. But what they're doing is they're not trying to say, right, we're going to live without oil tomorrow. They're saying, let's try and wean ourselves off it gradually. Let's think of strategies that's going to make, and it's not going to be a crunch point either, it's going to be a much more gradual process than that, but when it comes, let's become comfortable with it. Let's us manage it rather than the other way around.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll hear the investigation in full after the news at 9 o'clock. And we're staying on here until 9:45 to take your calls as ever. What do you make of this idea that you've heard there from Devon? Maybe you live in one of the areas that Mark's talked about in Scotland, which is hoping to become one of these towns as well. Is this something you would welcome, something that your community should sign up for, or are you hopeful of a different kind of future? 0500 92 9500 is the number for you to call.
92 to 95 FM and on digital. BBC Radio Scotland.
You can email morningextra@bbc.co.uk and you can text 80295. The news at 9 o'clock. Here's Callum Thompson. The Prime Minister has asked. You're listening to Morning Extra with Gary Robertson. Now on Radio Scotland, it's time for this month's investigation, which looks at one of Britain's fastest growing movements, that of transition towns. Now, before 9 o'clock, we were discussing whether this is an important new movement or just a passing fad. If you've just joined us, don't worry, because you're about to find out, as Mark Stephen follows One Town Search for a Better Future.
Now there are three steps to heaven.
This is on the scale of a wartime mobilisation. You know, this is a process that requires a coming together that's completely unprecedented. And my sense is that actually what's happening with transition towns is one of the most dynamic and important social movements of the 21st century.
And how would you respond to the usual claims that basically a bunch of ageing hippies, hearts are in the right place, brains are straight out the window, that you're not commercially hard-nosed, that you're not being realistic here?
I think that's an accusation that's very, very easy to throw at anything which is environmental, but I think one of the things that's quite unique with what we're doing in Transition Town Totnes is that there's no them and us about this. You know, whether this turns out in 5 years to have been completely delusional and pointless, we shall see.
I can't believe how quickly this project has taken off. We started off 6 months ago in one town in Devon doing this ourselves, and within about 6 months it's taken off, and hundreds of communities now contacting us saying, how can we do the same thing in our own area?
Yeah, that's sure. Seems like heaven to me.
Hello and welcome to Radio Scotland's monthly investigation. I'm Mark Stephen, and I'd like you to just imagine a time not terribly far in the future, say 10, maybe 15 years,
You walk out the front door of your house, which is entirely powered by solar or wind energy. You climb into your little solar-powered car and head off for work in a building that's also lit or heated or cooled by environmentally friendly methods. In this brave new world, folk have ditched their lawnmowers, dug up their grass and planted food instead. Employment's at an all-time high, with hundreds of new jobs in local construction, bioenergy, crafts and technology. You and your neighbours are pretty well debt-free. Debt stress is a thing of the past. You're even protected from the vagaries of the international finance scene by your very own currency, printed and distributed in your town. Now, I know this sounds fanciful, but actually, some folk are doing this today. They live in what are known as transition towns.
We've lived for the last 40, 50 years in what we might call the age of cheap oil, where we've had abundance of this incredible liquid which enables so much to happen that we've become completely dependent on it. And we've forgotten really about what it was that sustained us before. And so one of the key concepts to transition initiatives is what we call resilience. We're trying to rebuild what it was in our communities that enabled them to withstand shock from outside.
What is a transition town?
In essence, it's a process which acts as a catalyst in any community to say, how can this town prepare for life beyond cheap oil? So it's really looking at getting the community asking the right questions and developing the practicalities of a response to it.
If you can put aside the notion of endless economic growth, then actually in lots of ways the atomized culture and disenchanted nature of a lot of society nowadays can be counteracted by looking at relocalizing a lot more of our economy, our connectedness, our jobs and manufacturing, food production, etc. So bringing things closer to home, bringing the food closer to home, bringing manufacturing closer to home, in my view and in the view of the people who take a close look at it, could actually be a lot preferable to the way things are right now.
Rob Hopkins and Ben Brangwen there. I'm in Totnes in Devon, which is a sort of quintessentially English market town, 2-3 stories high, lots of natural stone and slate. And it's one of 15 so-called transition towns in Britain, which have already taken the plunge. Now, this idea is not just for aging hippies and bleeding heart greenies. In Totnes, local businesses, schools, even town councillors have all signed up to it.
My name is Robert Vent. I'm district councillor for Totnes Town, and I've been involved with Transition Town Totnes for the last 6 months or so.
Why did you get involved?
I thought it was probably the most inspiring project that I've seen in this town, really. It looked as if it was going to do something right across the spectrum for sorting out our environmental issues, sorting out our community problems, getting people together, creating jobs, dealing with a world after oil gets expensive.
This is my first visit to Totnes.
Yes.
It is, please don't get me wrong, it's quite an arty-farty town. There's lots of health food and whole food and organic shops and things like that. This will be a good place for an ageing hippie to come and retire. I mean, is that why this is particularly powerful here?
I think the vision is quite a bit wider than that. I mean, it's also interested in economic regeneration. It's interested in helping small businesses. It's interested in getting all sectors of the community to work together to sort out their problem.
Throughout this programme, you'll hear people using the phrase peak oil. It's a fairly simple concept. Basically, it suggests that the amount of oil and gas that we have available is finite, and that there will come a point when actually demand outstrips supply. Now, you talk to some people and they say that's going to be 20 years down the line, and you talk to others and they say actually it happened about 2 or 3 years ago. So when people talk about transition in context to peak oil, what they mean is a transition from an oil-dependent economy to one that's had to get used to using an awful lot less.
My name is Paul Wesley. I'm chair of the Totnes and District Chamber of Commerce.
How do the members of your chamber react? Because I could see a lot of businesses say, look, I've got enough problems trying to keep my head above water here, you know, trying to run a business without worrying about all this pseudo-hippie stuff.
Yes, well, absolutely right. Yes, the sort of thing that they would say. All the ideas do actually make economic sense, and they make economic sense now, but it also makes sense to plan for the long-term future. So, yes, sure, most people are looking to see what's going to happen over the next financial year, but very few are stupid enough not to think in longer terms, in the next 5 or 10 years.
Can you give me examples of where the principles of a transition town make economic sense?
It's not so much the principles of the practices. You know, if you look at something like energy conservation, I mean, we know that energy prices are going to increase. They will increase enormously eventually. We just don't know the timescale. But it makes a lot of sense if you start implementing energy conservation measures now, then they make immediate sense to you economically. So you don't even have to wait for global warming to post-peak oil to reap the benefits. You can reap them straight away. And someone said to me recently, they said, well, these transition town ideas won't work because people don't like change. You're kidding. People love change. I mean, people are changing their mobile phones and changing their clothes and changing their fashions and their reading materials faster than ever all the time. It's not change people are against at all. I mean, people are really up for it, but you've got to help them and facilitate them. And you know, if you've got businesses on board, then it's going to make some kind of sense. You know, it's not enough just to have individuals on board. Businesses are the people that have the big impact economically and environmentally.
So how do you get from where we are to this environmentalist's heaven? Well, as the old song says, there were three steps to heaven. Here in Totnes and in other transition towns, there are quite a few more.
The formula for heaven is very simple.
Step one, issuing your own local currency. My name is Mariana Kos. What we've been trying to do here in Totnes is to create a diversity of currencies. In our economy, we mainly live with just one currency, which is national currency, and we believe for a resilient community, we need more currencies. We need a variety of them to support different issues and support different goals. And the Totnes pound is the first small step in that direction.
What is the advantage in having your own pound?
Well, I think one of the advantages is that at the moment we only have the national currency, and this other currency is actually giving us a choice, so our lives are getting richer in that respect.
Aside from having a choice, what is the benefit?
Well, the reason we designed this local currency, or community currency as I prefer to call it, is actually to strengthen local economy, because these pounds will stay in Totnes, they will circulate here, and therefore they support local trade and they support local businesses.
What is the legality of printing your own money? How does the Exchequer feel about the fact you're producing your own money?
We haven't spoken to him yet, honestly. And we are planning to.
Just follow steps 1, 2 and 3.
Step 2, the local food economy. I'm Noni McKenzie, and what I've been involved in is preparing a local food guide. And the idea of this has been to share information, really, about how people can source local food in the shops, cafes, pubs and restaurants in Totnes.
But the fact that it's local does not necessarily make it good. It's not necessarily organic or any of those things.
Not necessarily, but it does mean that it's fresher. If it's just coming from close by, then it hasn't had to be refrigerated, it hasn't had to be genetically modified to make sure it'll last, it hasn't had to be irradiated. And also you can visit the producer, you can see how it's grown.
And what are the advantages to local people of accessing local food?
Well, the big advantage is encouraging the local economy. The supermarkets who source their food from a long way away, and even the shops, if they use a wholesale distributor who distributes stuff via Birmingham down to the southwest, they're encouraging a lot of food miles, and they're also discouraging local employment. Research has shown that those kind of operations employ a lot less people than a locally based distribution system. There's a lot less people doing administration, advertising, all those kind of jobs. If you're working in the local economy, all the jobs are connected directly with food, and they're local jobs supported by local people.
Telling people where to find what exists already is one thing. Another aspect of this, potentially, is producing more of your own food. Stopping thinking of yourself as a consumer and starting thinking of everybody as being potential producers. I'm trying not to disturb the branches of these trees too much because it is wet here in Totnes, which is a wild understatement. It has been coming down vertically since about 8 o'clock this morning. Rob Hopkins is the initiator of Transition Town Totnes. These are tiny saplings, not trees, essentially. What is the purpose of them?
I think one of the strange byproducts of the age of cheap oil, really, since the 40s, has been that we've been able to move to looking at our urban landscapes as being completely useless spaces. Acres of lawn, low-maintenance ground cover shrubs that produce absolutely nothing, ornamental trees, and it's a luxury, in inverted commas, which actually very few people in the past have actually had. Normally, the urban landscape has been seen as a useful space, orchards, allotments, market gardens, and so on. And part of the Totnes, the Nut Tree Capital of Britain project, it was going to be called Totnes, the Nut Capital of Britain, but everybody just nodded very sagely when we said that. So the idea is that we want to put back into the urban fabric productive trees. The beauty of them is that they can produce as much protein and carbohydrate an acre as any grain crop can. But in an urban environment, they're just there in around people, but they're building food security into where we live.
Looking at these trees, it's fairly obvious these aren't going to be feeding anybody fairly soon.
Normally walnuts don't start fruiting for 20 or 30 years. These are special varieties that will start cropping within 5 years. See, we've been brought up, I think, to believe that actually life before cheap oil basically consisted of nothing more than rolling around in the mud, shoving little boys up chimneys and beating children. Obviously, there's in no sense to sort of romanticise the past or to promote that we go back to the 1930s, but I think there has been an incredible vilification of a lot of the things that really underpinned a more resilient kind of a culture that we will be discovering.
It's not just the fact that we're getting old, that we've now got to that stage where we're saying, ah, I remember the days when bread tasted like bread. Your summers used to be summers.
No, I think it's when you start looking around, you know, Edward Wilson, the biodiversity writer, used to say the sign of any intelligent tinkering is that you keep all the pieces. And we haven't kept all the pieces. We've taken what was a system which wasn't perfect, but it did sustain us through times when things were very difficult, through the Second World War and so on. And we've taken that entire system and just thrown the entire thing in the skip and become totally dependent on globalized food distribution. And we've dismantled our manufacturing and outsourced it all to China. And that's going to come back to bite us very, very hard, I think, because we have very little to fall back on.
Step three.
Step three, energy growth. My name is Naresh Jangrande.
We've come into the cafe for obvious reasons because it is still teeming down outside. This has the advantage of being dry, warm, and the cappuccino is very good. What can you do in a town the size of Totnes to improve the energy situation, to wean people off an oil dependence?
Well, I guess our first step has been to say to people, well, we've got a problem. It's pretty urgent considering the size of the problem and the scale of the problem and the time scale it takes to develop alternatives. And our next step in that process was to commission a report. We had a consultant look at what is the renewable energy potential, just to see, well, how much can we generate? How much renewable energy can we generate in the South Hams? And we live in an area where we have a lot of renewable energy potential, both in terms of wind, in terms of wave, and also solar, biomass. He looked at the whole gamut of what was potentially possible, and we found that we could generate about 30% of our current energy use, which gave us a sense that it's doable if we create structures, if we create buildings, if we create ways of living that can greatly reduce our energy needs, that it is possible to generate the sort of energy we would need to live the sort of lifestyle we're living now.
This has only really been running for about the last 9 months, so it's unfair, but I'm going to do it anyway, to point out the fact that the lighting here in the cafe is still off the National Grid, the espresso machine, there's cars running up and down outside. So give me a concrete example of something you're working on at the moment to change to alternative energy.
We've set up what we call the Solar Water Heater Challenge, and we've gathered together a group of people who would be interested in bulk buying. So it's a very simple concept. We just bulk buy, and we achieve a discount as a result of bulk buying from both the manufacturer and also from the installer.
So you're going for economies of scale. What's the price differential? How much would it cost me as a private individual, and how much is it going to cost somebody as a member of the scheme?
So it depends on the system. There's evacuated tube systems and flatbed systems, and the evacuated tube system would probably cost you between £4,000 and £5,000 if you went to an installer and said, give me one of these systems, whereas we're going to get these systems for about £3,000, £3,200.
That's a substantial saving.
We're hoping that level of saving is going to encourage that many more people to go for renewable energy rather than stay with the old systems. And also, I think, as the price of energy rises, as the price of gas and electricity is, it's only going to go up, it's going to convince more and more people that they need to make this change in their lives.
And as life travels on, and things do go wrong,
Step four, the great reskilling. My name's Rob Hopkins and I'm the founder of Transition Town Totnes. The term kind of came to me a while ago when I was still living in Ireland and we used to run courses on clay plasters, how to dig a hole in the garden, see what kind of clay you had, make your own clay plasters, put them on, mix them up as plasters which would be durable and so on. And it struck me that actually the amount of people in Ireland at that time who knew how to do good clay plasters would probably fit on the back seat of my car. And the amount of people who will need to know how to use clay plasters when gypsum and cement and these other very, very high embodied energy products become unfeasible is an enormous degree of relearning in terms of construction, in terms of agriculture. Richard Heinberg talks about how when you take the oil out of an agricultural economy, you need to increase the amount of people employed by it significantly. And he talks about the UK needing to move from 500,000 to 8 million farmers over the next 20 years. Again, where are they going to learn? How many people know how to do it? And I think that nowadays, in this information economy, in many ways, I think we have a strong claim to being the most useless generation to have ever walked the planet in terms of very basic skills, cooking, building, mending, making things last. We've just become completely throwaway. Just listen to heaven and you will
plainly see. Step five is the business swap shops. I'm Fiona Ward. The swap shop started down the industrial estate, Totnes Industrial Estate, and we got 10 local businesses together and really just took them through a simple process where they identified what sort of waste they had, not only in terms of packaging like cardboard and plastics and things like that, but also spare resources. So they might have spare space in their warehouse, they might have half-empty delivery vans running up to London once a week. They might have some spare manual labour that's not used all the time. And we just got them together and highlighted what they had to spare and then also what they wanted. And at the end of the day, I think we had something like 55 needs or wants, as we called them, and we managed to match about 38 of them.
See, I can see two advantages in that. One, it builds a community that's got more cohesion. But it's also economically much more efficient.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a good example of that was a company called Pedrix, which is a local removal company. And they basically said that they would take everybody's spare cardboard boxes because at the moment they're having to drive 50 miles to go and pick up and buy new cardboard boxes. And yet there's hundreds or probably even thousands of these going spare on the industrial estate where there's about 90 businesses all having to pay at the moment to get their waste taken away.
And would it be possible to talk to one of the local businesses involved?
Yes, let's go down to Totnes Museum, see if Alan's in.
Is it something particular about Totnes, or do you think this would work in other areas?
I think it would work anywhere you like. The only difference with Totnes is it's probably more receptive to these sort of schemes.
Why? What makes them more receptive?
I don't know. People have regarded Totnes as an alternative area. It was once described by an airline as the fourth most funkiest town in the world. I think perhaps Totnes is trying to live up to it. I mean, I think back to the 1960s, for example. Well, I grew up in Totnes. And when Totnes was quite a mucky town, it was a market town. It had a cattle market. It had three very basic industries, timber importing, the bacon factory, and it had the creamery. It was a mucky town, but it had a purpose. And it was post-war era, and people didn't throw away things. People hoarded stuff. If you had a piece of wood, you either kept it or you burnt it. You didn't just throw it away to landfill.
So far, transition towns have been almost a purely southern phenomenon. There has been a lot of interest from Scotland too. There's groups in East Kilbride and West Kilbride, one in Edinburgh, another in Portobello, have all been in contact with the organisers down in Totnes. But I'd like to come further on the coast to Dunbar to talk to another couple of people, Phil Revel and Mark James, about their aspirations to turn what's quite a deuce wee coastal town into Scotland's first transition town.
Oh, we're very early stages. We've got a meeting planned for a couple of days' time and there's been a good amount of interest already.
How do you get the message across, Bob?
Well, first thing we've got to do is raise general awareness of the challenges that we face, how things are going to have to change in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
What do you think the major obstacles are likely to be? Because there are bound to be obstacles.
Firstly, that people will deny that there's going to be a need for rapid change, and secondly, that there'll be a technological fix, that everything will be okay. That's what I think will really stop people from taking it seriously and really wanting to change how their lives are.
Is Dunbar ready for the concept of transition town?
There are different organisations within the town that show awareness already.
And we have a Dunbar Community Woodland group. I mean, there is a core group of people who I think we can build the project around.
Hall Hill Healthy Living Centre has a couple of wind turbines and it has solar panels on the roof. And there's a wind farm south of Dunbar, and there's going to be a large expansion of that, and another one going to be built.
Plus the new administration, well, both nationally and locally in the council. I mean, I think local councillors are certainly very keen and supportive, so there are strong links there.
And if you can get it to work here, do you think other people will follow suit?
I think very definitely, yes. I mean, the whole movement seems to be taking off in an exponential way at the moment. Groups are springing up all across England, and there's a lot of interest in Scotland. The whole idea is spreading rapidly. I think the time is right for it. Yeah, that's sure. Seems like heaven's
left to pass. Fundamentally, I remain very optimistic that the same ingenuity, creativity, adaptability that got us all the way from the Industrial Revolution up to the top of this fossil fuel peak we're standing on now can get us down the other side. But it does take a lot of rethinking and an incredible amount of ingenuity, really.
Rob Hawkins, the man who invented the concept of transition towns, and that report was from Mark Stephen. The investigation was a Triple Echo production for BBC Radio Scotland. Now, Mark is still with us, and we're going to take your calls, because I want to hear from you this morning. What do you think about life after the oil runs out? Are these transition towns an inspired idea, or do you think, to put it bluntly, they're just a crazy notion? Would it work where you live? Maybe you live in one of the areas in Scotland that's keen to put this into practice. Maybe you've got questions you want to put to Mark. Well, he's the man to answer them. 0500 92 95 00 is the number to call. You can send an email, of course, to morningextra@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295. And, of course, as it is the first Monday of the month, we'll stay on air until 9:45 to take your calls. Fred will be with you at 9:45. Let's speak to Mandy, who's on the line first of all this morning. Mandy, good morning to you.
Hi there. Hi there.
What do you make of the idea you've heard there from Devon then?
Well, I must confess, I'm aware of transition towns. I'm actually a bit of an energy campaigner in my spare time. And I think it's wonderful that you've actually been airing this. I've been speaking to groups for several years about peak oil and the sort of economic impacts and trying to make people realise that it's kind of the other side of the climate change coin. And the transition town movement, again, I've seen it with my own eyes. It has gone, it's just captured so many people's imagination. And I am aware that there's, you know, groups round about Scotland now as well.
But is it sustainable for the long term? Is it something of a passing fad?
No, well, who knows? But I certainly hope, I think it is the way of the future, because we have to change the way we do things. I mean, as a Green, you know, I mean, Greens have been banging on about localising things for many years. But as the cost of oil rises, which was made quite clear in your programme, everything that we absolutely rely on will inherently become more expensive.
Although the point that was also made in the programme is that we're going to have to reinvent the wheel, in effect, because we're all so used now to buying goods from abroad and buying them conveniently, and we're going to have to maybe think about producing things ourselves in a way that we haven't done up until now.
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's really important that this movement is kicking off now. Because although I think peak oil is a bit closer than the oil companies seem to say, even the oil companies say 20 years. Now, you look back 20 years, all we seem to have done is develop more and more gadgets and more energy. Even though we do talk about energy efficiency, we just buy more gadgets. We have to rethink the way we do things. And one thing, I'm not sure if it was mentioned, but I know the transition towns, part of their reskilling process is to learn from the older people in society. Now, I know Devon, Totnes in Devon, is a bit of a market town still, but there's a transition town scheme in Brixton, of all places. You know, there are people trying to take this into very urban settings and trying to show that there's no formula. You know, there's the 12 steps, but every community is different, every community's got different resources, and I think the exciting thing is communities taking on the challenge for themselves and saying, right, what can we do? What's going to be a problem? Where do we need to invest some, you know, ingenious thinking to fulfil future needs? And again, if it's all pie in the sky, then we're still reducing our energy footprint, which is good for climate change. So I see it as a win-win situation.
And if it happened where you are, what would you be good at? Your green fingered, for instance? Would you survive?
Well, if it happened where I am, I stay in quite a rural area, sort of 4 miles from West Calder. There's a lot of farmland around, but it definitely takes a core number of people to do some very hard work initially. Raising awareness of a topic people aren't that interested in is a very difficult thing to do. But as for me personally, I mean, I've spent too much of my life stuck on a computer, but I can, you know, explain things to people. I can, you know, give talks, speak in public, and I think awareness raising is what needs to happen now right across Scotland, and we need to learn from places like Dunbar and spread the word and make people realise that you can do something and you get a fulfilment from not just sitting back and thinking, oh my God, climate change is terrible and look at the price of petrol. You know, get off your ass and actually do something.
You get fulfilment, Mandy, but you also get blisters.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Well, I'll explain that comment. I mean, I chaired a conference at the Museum of Scotland 2 years ago for an organisation called ODACS, Oil Depletion Analysis Centre.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things somebody said there was 95% of all our transport, and by transport, you know, planes, ships, cars, lorries, tractors, you name it, tractors particularly I'm thinking of here, are powered by oil.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have an option on those. I mean, there's no such thing as a plane that flies by any other means. But tractors, the other day I ended up turning an acre of hay by hand. I won't go into the details, but I had to do
For technical reasons,
I had to do it by hand. I couldn't just bring a tractor and a machine in to do it. It took me all day, and I was completely, and the thought of actually cutting it, turning it, making it, we've got so accustomed to machines doing the work for us, it is crippling when you try the manual alternative.
I absolutely agree. I mean, this is one of the things people forget about oil. Our food production is so, and it's not just the pesticides and fertilizers which are made from oil products. It's like you said, the farm equipment, the tractors, the combine harvesters, even drilling. You know, I mean, we all know, you know, you've seen pictures of folk having to plant by hand. Yes, it's incredibly energy intensive, and this is what cheap oil has given us. It's given us cheap energy.
Okay, Mandy, I'm going to leave it there because I want to hear from some others as well. 0500-925-00 is the number to call. I wonder whether you think ultimately we'll come up with some kind of alternative to the oil. So maybe we won't need to go down the route that's being explored here. 0500-925-00. We're on air until 9:45, so get your calls in now. Now, before we go any further, Debbie has your travel news.
Thanks, Kerry. Well, flooding still causing problems in the A96 near to the turn-off for Aberdeen Airport. Traffic's very heavy, especially eastbound, and we've also got flooding reported in the A90 at Newton Hill. In Midlothian, the A701 is completely closed at Goutley Moss near Pennycook. That's following an earlier accident, and you're being diverted via the A702. And then heading into Glasgow, MH traffic still solid westbound from Junction 13 Provan through to the Kingston Bridge, and looking at delays of around 15 minutes on the northbound M77. BBC Radio Scotland Travel. I'll be back just after 10.
Alan in Dalkeith sends a text. 80295 is the number. He says, I'm very impressed by this project you've been talking about in Totnes and Devon, but not at all convinced about the idea of this multiple currency. Carry on, as he calls it. Why the need, he asks. And Marguerite says she wonders whether the Findhorn community is similar, although she says she thinks the programme is sending some excellent home truths because we're useless at looking after ourselves. I thought about the Findhorn community as well, yes, when I was listening to the programme, Mark, but not the same thing, really.
It's not really the same. They share a lot of the same principles, but very often for a different end result. You know, this is purely and simply looking at what happens when oil starts to deplete, what happens when it becomes so expensive, when the price of getting a barrel of oil out of the ground is actually greater than the value, you know, that you are prepared to pay. And again, it's sitting at about $70 a barrel at the moment. I heard a chap speak a couple of years ago from America, who's, you know, and he was an energy advisor for George W., saying actually the 200 barrel would not be, you know, too expensive.
It's
$200 per barrel. You know, they thought that was absolutely feasible and quite acceptable. And you just imagine what it would do to the city of Glasgow if you were paying that for fuel.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's Genevieve, who says, I live in Dunbar. I believe the time is right to move forward in this way. It's already happening here. Well, indeed, and we've pointed that out. She says, thank you for your excellent programme. I think that's directed at you, Mark, rather than me.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Let's speak to Ian, who's with us. Ian, good morning to you.
Morning,
guys. Hi, you're involved in a project in Inverness, I gather.
Yes, it's called the REAL Project. It runs in Inverness High School, and what's happened is they've turned over an acre of the school grounds to create a local farm, The aim originally was to give some of the school leavers a bit of sort of relevant experience to prepare them for the adult world when they left the school.
And is it popular with them, or would they rather be on their Nintendo?
It's only in its second year. The first lot who went through, I think they definitely get something out of it. All three of them have gone on to either college or jobs. I see it as my job to try and make it interesting to them. It's early days yet, but we're quite hopeful.
And ultimately, though, we'd need to do this on a much bigger scale if we're to have the kind of results that we've heard about on the investigation this morning. Is there enough enthusiasm, do you think, amongst young people for this kind of thing?
I think once the reality of the situation that food prices are going to go up, then people will start to take on board these ideas. Basically, I think people only respond to situations when they absolutely need to. Now, the price of food is already going up. At the moment, in our society, we use 10 times as much energy to produce our food as we get from our food. So as the price of oil goes up, which it inevitably will, the price of food will go up. The price of food is going to go up this winter, and I think that is going to lead to an increased sort of enthusiasm for growing your own food. Sometimes it is hard work, but we're not talking about people needing to feed themselves. We're talking about them making a contribution towards feeding themselves.
There is actually a very alarming thing that's looming up on the horizon too in prospect. Another thing that oil price has been tied to is the cost of biodiesel.
Yeah.
Now, if oil becomes expensive and biodiesel becomes more feasible, then logically, you know, there's not enough land in the UK to grow what we actually require. So if you go to developing countries and you say to them, right, fine, you grow it for us, which is fine until they've got a drought or until they've got a requirement for food, and it puts them into a very, very perilous situation.
And let me just throw this into the mix. Martin's just sent an email to saying regarding food miles, he said, you want to consider that the UK has only enough available agricultural land to feed about 6 million people. Where are the other 50 million going to get their daily bread?
Yeah, I don't think that's true, to be honest. I think, as it stands at the moment, the way we're actually producing it, yes, he's absolutely right, but that could be changed.
In terms of the bioethanol situation, I mean, I was reading on BBC website just a few weeks ago that the American economy is demanding so much corn from Mexico to make bioethanol that the price of the tortilla corn that the Mexican peasant population use for their staple food is increasing, and there have been riots in Mexico City because people are no longer able to afford staple food. It's very interesting, and, you know, but it's like the bigger the problem, the bigger the potential for change, the bigger the opportunity for real localization. And growing food is very good for you personally. It's a very worthwhile thing. It helps to bring communities back together. The demand for the food that we can grow, we can't possibly grow enough because there is an awareness and an appreciation that local food is far superior to anything that Tesco or any of the other corporations that are dragging us down this road are ever going to be able to produce.
Well, as your project shows, Ian, we have to learn the basics, though, first. Thanks very much indeed for that. Nice to speak to you this morning. It strikes me, if it's all about growing our own food, that come the future, you and Frieda Morrison will be fine, Mark, and the rest of us might struggle. Let's speak to Joanne in Troon. Joanne, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi there. Tell us about the organisation you're involved in Ayrshire.
Well, we're called Localised Ayrshire, so we cover the whole of Ayrshire, and what we're trying to do is really to inform and to try and get businesses and the ordinary public to make changes to things like where they buy their produce, their energy in their homes, and also how to access the parliaments to try and get changes in, you know, politically with legislation, because a lot of legislation is actually hindering localisation, certainly in areas of dairy, for example. You cannot hand pour milk, so we have like one of the cheese making companies in Ayrshire. I cannot buy goat's milk from them because they'd have to hand pour it, and well, certainly EU regulations don't allow that. It has to be machinery, which needs energy, which of course needs oil, and also we've got the whole climate change thing as well.
But is there an issue here of health and safety that we need to protect the public, or do you think it's gone too far?
I think it's gone too far, to be honest. Yes, way too far, because you know what's the point in having all these stringent regulations when you're going to have people starving? I'm sorry, I'm maybe over-exaggerating there, but, you know, you've got to look at the whole picture, and it's, I hate the expression, but it's down to joined-up thinking, because one thing has an effect on another thing and another thing, just like they were talking about the biodiesel there, because that's going to push up food prices. you don't want to be producing more fuel so that we can drive our cars the way we're doing it. Mm-hmm. We need to cut back. We need to make changes now. We can't live like this.
Joanne, I was in the supermarket the other day trying to buy apples and came away without any, purely and simply because, you know, I looked at where they came from. And it was South Africa, Chile, New Zealand, and you thought, this is a low-value commodity. How can it be economically viable to take it from the other side of the world and sell it here at this kind of price? And if you try and find, you know, Scottish apples or UK apples, it is practically impossible. And it is... I mean, I agree with you. I get very uncomfortable. People say, well, folk are going to go hungry, you know, but potentially it is possible.
Well, it's all as well down to seasonal eating. We have got so used to food coming into our supermarkets from all over the world to give us that variety at any time of the year. And there is certainly a big push by the National Farmers Union, and also there's also an initiative by the Scottish Conservatives too, and it's about buying local, eat local. And this is what they're saying, look, this is the seasonal veg. We're going to have to pull back here and start thinking about this. I won't buy strawberries from another country. I will stick to British, preferably Scottish.
There's plenty of them here, but I suppose then it goes back to this whole thing again about back to basics, I suppose, which is ultimately many of us don't know how to cook these vegetables, whether they're seasonable or not. But Joanne, I'm just going to leave it there just because I want to rattle through a couple more calls and a couple more emails as well. Here's Jules, who says, this sounds a brilliant idea, a really exciting, growing movement. Any new idea always gets the usual moans and accusations of being impractical, but the sceptic should wake up and realise that something has to be done about our destruction of the environment, and soon. So why not support this, says Jules. Well, talking of sceptics, here's Joe, who says, Gary, I can't help feeling all of this is very sanctimonious and naive. There's only a very narrow and selective grasp of economics going on here. Economic growth is what supports the population. This is based on trade, which in turn is supported by currency convergence, financial mechanisms, etc. And this in turn supports technological development and medical advances based on the creation of surplus and trade. The whole project is only possible because of the huge infrastructure of the conventional economy supporting it. Excuse me, he says finally, the ultimate result of this project is population decrease, infant mortality, low life expectancy. The nice people of Totnes will be the first to look for someone else to provide medicine for their sick kids, or will they just slap herbs on them, he asks.
I think he's absolutely right. I think he's absolutely right that, you know, all of those things are true, that, you know, we could be looking at increased infant mortality, we could be looking at the reduce of medicines, we could be, but his option is not sustainable. The oil will run out. Right now, we don't have an option. When that happens, what do you do? And that's, I mean, it may be that the people in Totnes are pie in the sky and, you know, basically just blowing smoke, but they're thinking about it, and I think that's the most important thing.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much indeed for all of your endeavours this morning. Thanks for all of your calls and emails as well. Far more of them, as usual, than we're able to get through, but thank you very much for getting in touch. The time is 9:45 on BBC Radio Scotland.
That was a play by Roy Scheider from Bergen in Norway, and not a lot of people know that.